100 years after the Great War, we look at war poetry on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Leo Schubert recently ruminated on war poetry. We'll get an encore from him today on Scribble. Whatever prompted that?
The idea of using on the 100th celebration of the Great War, and well, it's been something roaming around the back of my head for many years. I happen to have also an English major from many, many years ago, and I had read poetry, plus the fact I had lived in Verdun during France during my 7th and 8th grade years and played a lot around the battlefields there and my friends on bicycles. And then later, when my father was stationed in Paris, everybody that came to visit us, you had to take them on a tour. And since I was back and forth from the University of Iowa till I was 22, I had walked many of the places and been there. So it's always been an interest, not to mention the fact my father had served 18 months during World War One. So I grew up with history in my life of people talking about.
What was he still doing in France?
Well, when World War II came along, he applied for a job at Arsenal, believe it or not, as a sheet metal worker. They discovered he could read and write and spoke fluent German due to our grandparents who came from Germany and lived in Clinton County, Iowa, and found out he had known construction. So they put him in the legal branch. And then as soon as he could, he was with the Corps of Engineers. And one of the places he went to as a civilian was first Germany and then eventually air bases in the early 1950s were being put together by the Air Force in the eastern part of France for jet interceptors during the Cold War. And so he was assigned to several locations, Verdun, Metz, Chambly Air Base, Toul-Rosières. We moved around a lot, and consequently I moved schools a lot.
That was a great way in many ways to grow up, not as simple for schooling as staying at one school, but still to have that variety of experiences must have been great.
Well, I have what they officially call a military brat, so I had no trouble walking in a room and being or a brand new school in the middle of the year, being always the new kid and being nervous and wondering about, you know, how you are. But I put the fake face on and I just feel, well, I have to be here. This is it.
Uh-huh.
You're used to that after a while. And, of course, you maybe not fit in too well some places you go because people don't understand sometimes what your background is.
Yeah, that's true. But poetry grew out of a study in college?
No, well, our home, this was at a time where obviously we had no television. I still to this day watch very little television unless it's public television or old films on
TCM.
That
was a great time to grow up.
Yeah, I was a radio listener and our home was filled with books wherever we went and you had to. With my mom and my dad, you just had to do things. So if you were I remember one time, I don't know, I was about 12 somewhere. We're in Ulm, Germany. Well, we've got to climb to the top of the cathedral there because somehow my parents knew it was something like the tallest structure in Europe that was masonry stone stacked on top of each other. So I don't know how many hundred steps we had went to the top just to say you have to do it while you're here. So naturally, the interest in history and geography, I mean, I just grew up in a family that you knew things. Your table talk at dinner was about politics or religion or history or music. And so I'm one of those people someone wrote a song about once. I remember the line was, you know a little bit about a lot of things. And I think there's a word for that, as a dilettante or something. But
listen, I am a proud dilettante. There are people who accuse me of being a scholar, and I tell them no.
No, I'm not.
I'm
either.
Not deep in anything, but I know a little bit about a lot.
And I know where to find it. And I'll tell you, Don, I'm still curious about it. I mean, the question why, that was one of the earliest things I learned. And in all the years I taught, it dawned on me after about the first 8 or 9, curiosity. Children are pretty much the same. You say they're all different. But if you could teach them to be curious, their behaviors change. They want to dig and probe and ask questions.
Well, so, you're here, Leo, because a couple of weeks ago, a few weeks ago, you did a program at the Putnam Museum on remembering the Great War, World War I, through poetry. Did that begin with a question or curiosity? Or
no, I just I think I can actually tell you the beginning of that. Sometime in the 1960s, in the old Bettendorf or the downtown Davenport Library, I came to the Quad Cities in 1965 to do some teaching, and I hung out at the library and I found a book that was a collection of World War I poetry put together, and I can't think who it is now, but he was a well-known commentator, radio and television personality. And so you saw an anthology of, well, you know, Wilfred Owen, for example, and any number of them. And I still read my poetry books. Sometimes I just pull stuff off the shelf and decide to read a chapter or a poem or two and put it back. I'm not a novelist reader. I just go to my books when I want to know something before I end up. If I have books on the subject, I don't use the internet because I find a lot of conflicting information on the internet sometimes. But, you know, I trust my books.
But you decided to do this program at the Putnam.
Yes.
And that was at their instigation?
Well, of course, you realize my wife, Susan, is an officer in the Putnam Guild. And she said, well, and she and I have done joint speeches together for a community foundation to how the importance of donating and to help your community. And I have done several Memorial Day talks in my little hometown of Lost Nation, Iowa, the cemetery, which is still a big event on Memorial Day. And I often talk about to people, and I make a point of even the Star Spangled Banner is best recited reading the punctuation than it is being sung. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Flanders Fields, that poem, I hear people, you know, it's just wonderful, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, stop, take a breath, da-da-da-da-da. No, it's not written that way. The meaning changes. And the inflection you give it and the importance of it.
I think that's partly because, like many people my age, I had to memorize that in fourth grade.
Yes.
Right? In Flanders Field, the poppies grow between the crosses, row on row, and so forth.
Yeah. Well, do you have a copy of Flanders Field?
Oh, well, it's in my head, but I can read it just in case I flub it up. Yeah. No, the way I also, Don, think you don't just stand at a podium and read to people when you give a talk. You're on stage. Part of it, it sounds bad to say, is entertainment. It's certainly an ego trip to be able to do things that other people can't do. So you got to hook this audience somehow, you see. And it's just nice sometimes to step away from a podium and go out maybe to the first table of people sitting there. And you get to the line in Flanders Fields, take up our quarrel with the foe, and just go right at them. Uh-huh. Take up to you with failing hands and point at individuals, you know, not in a threatening way, but make eye contact with whomever you're reading to, rather than looking down at the page. And so, you know, like Flanders Fields, there again, it's interesting. Why did he put blow and grow? Well, this made me do some research when I started thinking about doing this. I read several versions and other things I found that said John McCrae, who wrote it, he wrote it different ways at different times. It's much like sheet music. People write many versions of it. You know, we hear a certain performance, maybe like Mozart or somebody, or Beethoven. Here, there's other. He did other things for a while, too, or the Gettysburg Address. How many versions are there of that? Now we have one we accept as the real one, but there are other versions of Lincoln's scribbles on that. And so, Flanders Fields to me was a perfect way to end it because everyone knows it. Secondly, I don't think people realize how important the poppy is. Why? And I wore my poppies for this speech, my collection of Memorial Day poppies I get at the cemeteries every year when I visit. In that part of France, Flanders, that province, Picardy, those regions, poppies grow wild. Hillsides and pastures are full of red for that very short time. And if you've ever tried to grow poppies in your flower garden, they bloom and they don't last long at all. And, for example, the highway, and I never can remember the name, that's why we have maps, there's an interstate through Kentucky near Fort Campbell, Kentucky. And the interstate median there, certain times of the year, is full of red poppies. Of course, it's Fort Campbell's headquarters of one of the two airborne companies that were in Normandy. I never know if it's the 101st or the 89th, but I know it's one of those two.
Why don't you give us a version of Flanders Field?
I will go with one. Let me put a cheat sheet here just in case I get too excited with this microphone. But John McCrae had been in Flanders. His poem was written. He was a surgeon, but he wanted to be in the war, so he volunteered for an artillery unit. But he was officiating at a service of a good friend of his who had died in the combat, and supposedly that got him to thinking about that. But he wrote it like this. We'll do this. In Flanders fields, the poppies blow between the crosses, row on row, that mark our place. And in the sky, the lark, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard amid the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved. Now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields.
Very nice.
When was that written in?
It had to be, well, let me think.
That had to be not long after the...
It was 1915, May of 1915. Yeah. There was
so before America had really gotten involved.
In the... And that's the other thing that's sort of interesting. One of the things, speaking of my parents, they would wherever we lived, they kept bringing things home for me when I was a younger person. My idea of a niftiest toy in the world would be to find an old antique toy cannon that was about six inches long in an old junk shop, or books. I have a 2-volume set of the First War in French, leather bound. Probably 12 by 8 or 9 inches square, full of photographs. The American section is about 4 pages. The Senegalese, a French colony, has a greater amount of events in the First War than the Americans do. We were there for a very short period of time. Granted, we lost a lot of men because of the Meuse-Argonne offensive. We weren't doing trench warfare, though, so it was a different way. But
That whole war was...
Well, how much American poetry was there about... I would imagine, just as Americans' attitude toward the war shifted from before we got in till once we got in, right? So poetry would shift.
Well, I picked some that I like. So you have to understand, I do things that I know and but what I like. And I used 2 pieces of U.S. poetry, one by Sarah Teasdale that I've often admired. I'm a avid reader years ago of books and science fiction stuff, and I ran into it. And it's actually in, I believe, in the Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury, a story called There Will Come Soft Rains. And that's one by Sarah Teasdale, who was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And in 1917, she wrote a piece, simple rhymed couplet. I memorized it years ago, and I think of it every spring. And that's another thought I was trying to hang things together on in this little talk, how often spring shows up. But Sarah Teasdale was one I used because she's commenting on the tremendous, the brutality, the horror, the deaths of the war. She realized we're at a point in 1917 where humans are capable of wiping themselves out with our weapons that were used in that war that had never been used before. Poison gas, submarines. I mean, serious use of the submarine. Tanks. German machine guns firing 500 rounds a minute while British troops are running at them across an open field. Or the Battle of the Somme. You spend one whole week British bombarding the German trenches. One whole week. And then 7:30 one morning, it's time for the men to go up and over the top. And I read somewhere in one of my books, by nightfall, 57,000 British soldiers were dead, missing, or wounded.
Incredible the number of people that
in
died.
In one day. And it went on for another 141 days.
Right. Yeah.
And they gained, I've read two accounts of it in my old books, well, possible major gains over a 12-mile front was something like either 6 miles or 8 miles that the British gained.
Let's hear Sarah Teasdale.
Well, hers is, there will come soft rains and the smell of the ground, and swallows circling with their shimmering sounds, frogs in the pools singing at night, and wild plum trees in tremulous white. Robins will wear their feathery fire, whistling their whims on a low fence wire. And not one will know of the war. Not one will care at last when it is done. Not one will mind, neither bird nor tree, if mankind perished utterly. And spring herself, when she woke at dawn, would scarcely know that we are gone.
That's painfully true. Painfully true.
So I had to put that one in because I'd started with Alan Seeger's Rendezvous, Alan Seeger is the Harvard graduate, published writer, author, 28-year-old man, was overseas. He wanted to get into the fray. He had this idea. It's hard for me to explain or even understand, but it was this personal responsibility to die for your country. It's not so much personal glory. Don't get that wrong. It's this idea that we must sacrifice. He wrote to his parents. He was in France. Of course, the U.S. was neutral. He couldn't really legally fight for France, so he joined the French Foreign Legion, and that could be the topic of another speech, while the French Foreign Legion works. They ask no questions. And so he immediately was trained. He was made an officer, put in charge of 45 men. Four of them returned from their initial assault on the Germans' lines. But he had written earlier a poem that talks about spring that come to mind every spring. I look forward to the thing. And he called it Rendezvous, if I may just go to that part. He said, I have a rendezvous with death. At some disputed barricade, when spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air, I have a rendezvous with death, when spring brings back blue days and fair. Maybe he shall take my hand and lead me into his dark land and close my eyes and quench my breath. It may be I shall pass him still. I have a rendezvous with death on some scarred slope of battered hill when spring comes round again this year and the first meadow flowers appear. God knows 'twere better to be deep pillowed in silk and scented down where love throbs out in blissful sleep, pulse nigh to pulse and breath to breath, and where hushed awakenings are dear. But I have a rendezvous with death at midnight in some flaming town when spring trips north again this year. And I to my pledged word am true. I shall not fail that rendezvous. He writes that. He's killed. He writes that just before the war, or as he gets into it. He's killed on July 4th, 1916, The Battle of the Somme opened with the troops on July 1. 4 days later, he's dead in France.
That was just so insane. You know, you look at the history of war. Every war is fought following the pattern of the previous war,
exactly.
Ignoring the fact that there are new elements in it. And the machine guns, you think, are you guys crazy? You're going to an open charge across a field against machine guns? You got to be insane.
Yeah, and the German, I mean, they're firing 500 rounds a minute, water-cooled, interchangeable barrels. I read one thing was translated from a German soldier some years ago at one of the trench. No, I kept my remarks for the trench warfare on the Western Front, realizing it was quite different on the Eastern Front and the rest of the places in the world, even in the colonies in Africa. The problem was that they're entrenched, and yet the British insisted. There are photographs in some of my books of British officers coming up the ladders over the trenches, leading their men, carrying only a cane to lead them into battle. And we do have photos, motion pictures, of 8 or 9 soldiers at a time dropping just a few feet from their trenches. It's just unbelievable. And then the poison gas.
Yeah.
Chlorine, phosgene. There was a person, a friend of my father's who also served, but he had served in France in the war. My father never got out of the country. He quit University of Iowa and his unit in his Student Army Training Corps unit. They all enlisted in 1917. But Herman McCandy was his name. He's long deceased. And his wife and my mother went to high school together. He had a touch of gas. He never was quite the farmer he was. You know, the family took care of things. But we'd visit him regularly when we were in the States, and we were back a lot due to my father's opportunities with his job. And we'd go back and forth. And he would be on his, we used to call him kind of a settee, you know, reclining couch type thing. And he would tell me stories of what it was like in the Meuse-Argonne and fighting and that sort of thing. But he always had this lung condition, just a whiff of mustard gas.
Yeah, there was a fellow who worked with my father who had been gassed in the First World War, and it just was so debilitating.
Yeah, my father-in-law was gassed, and he was part of the 33rd Illinois Division, which got the brunt of the gas. And I remember him coughing all night when we would stay at his house.
Oh,
he farmed, but he was not in good shape.
Read us another poem.
Well, to go through this, I started out with Seeger showing that idea, and I based that on the piece of an ode written by Horace, where he was urging Romans at one time, young men, to join the cause to fight against whoever some Roman legions were fighting somewhere. And that was quite a common, call in England when the war broke out. Using that Latin word of dulce et decorum est pro patria mori, that it's sweet or it's fitting and proper to die for your country. And you see, that's Alan Seeger's point of view. This is what I have to do. It's something I must do, is to die. And it's not even his country, but it's this idea. And so then I went from his to another interesting idea, and I've never I talk about not being able to fully, totally comprehend it. It's a Rupert Brooke piece, was my second one of six, that he wrote, Rupert Brooke wrote it called The Soldier. I don't know if you're familiar with that one or not. Yeah. But he has a little take on that idea, and it's where he is England. It's hard to explain that being an Englishman, he embodies everything that's England. And so when he dies, England is there in the ground where his corpse is. It's quite an interesting piece. When you think, I've studied it at length over the years. He writes, "If I should die, think only this of me, that there's some corner of a foreign field that is forever England. There shall be in that rich earth a richer dust concealed, a dust whom England bore, shaped, made aware, gave once her flowers to love, her ways to roam. A body of England's, breathing English air, washed by the rivers, blessed by the sons of home. And think, this heart, all evil shed away, a pulse in the eternal mind, no less, gives somewhere back the thoughts by England given. Her sights and sounds, dreams happy as her day, and laughter learnt of friends, and gentleness in hearts at peace under an English heaven. Now, I've been to cemeteries a lot. I mean, I'm family members who were soldiers, brothers, dad, uncle. I've never really stood there and thought, this plot of ground is America, the United States. But that's an interesting concept.
Well, it's taking nationalism to the level of religion. And, you know, in other words, everything about your country is sacred. And that is a danger. It really is a danger because we live in a world where we've got to get over nationalism. We really do.
Rupert Brooke is another man, you know, so much for dulce and decorum est pro patria mori. He died of an infection that he encountered. Actually, while his unit, he was in a naval unit that was being transferred to what we now call Constantinople, that whole region, for another offensive, which was terribly brutal to the British. Anyway, he died on a hospital ship during the war also. But you know, I didn't stay away from all Americans. Yeah, we have to have the American spirit, you know, there. So I did add one in there too. So
it's a fascinating thing. And when you look at the whole spectacle of war and you realize that for many, many men especially, war is very attractive. It feeds that dominant feeling. Men want to dominate. And that is probably the most destructive thing in the world if you don't keep it under some kind of control. But dear me, after the First World War, it's as if nature said, oh, you think you can kill people? Watch me.
Right.
I mean, we lost 5% of the world's population in that flu epidemic.
Right at the end.
Staggering, yeah. It made the wars, the horrors of the loss in the war, look insignificant. It was just an amazing thing. And ever since then, you know, we've been very nervous about the flu.
Well, and getting the numbers fascinated me in a way, how they even know how many. I mean, there's numbers that 10 million people may have been killed in World War I. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you keep those numbers. There was one even read on that Battle of the Somme that talked about, I think the number was something like somewhere of 57,451. Now, how did you know? When I lived in Verdun, France, they're still picking up bones, throwing them into a monument that you can look in the open crypt, you know, the glass thing of bones that farmers turn up. Or come, and there's something like 60-some acres around Verdun, France, where they fought for 4 years and held the Germans. I think there's 69 equivalent some acres that are designated as, I won't call it holy ground, whatever the French call it in France, but you're not allowed in there because it can't be developed. First, there's too many explosives still in there.
And we are running out of time, but the idea of war poetry, it's beautiful and moving, but it is war. And I hope we never have to do a whole lot of war poetry.
Well, that's why I wanted to put it together, where it starts out with this glorified idea and ends with, and of course,
I certainly don't see much war poetry anymore.
No, you don't.
I haven't read one about Afghanistan. Well, Vietnam War had its poets, but they were anti-war.
Well, Leo Schubert was our guest today. I'm Don Woot with Roll Tweet. We're out of time, and we'll be back next week for another edition of Scribble.